Hi, this is Yannikin Smucker. I'm a co-editor of the Oral History Review, and I'm really delighted to be here for our next installment of OHR Conversations, our recorded discussions, light interviews with authors of articles that we publish in the journal. Joining me today are the co-authors of our recently published article, Toward an Ethos of Trans Care in Trans Oral History. Welcome to Elspeth Brown and Merle Beam. Elspeth is a professor of history at the University of Toronto and director of the LGBTQ Oral History Digital Collaboratory at that university. And Merle is currently visiting assistant professor in the Department of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at McAllister College. Merle is the former oral historian for the Treader Trans Oral History Project at the University of Minnesota. And so they both bring a wealth of experience in trans oral history, working at prominent centers that really focus in on this subject. And their beautiful article, which I definitely encourage you all to read, takes a really sensitive approach to thinking about archival practices, as well as motivations for project, and how in our current 21st century moment, when to sort of quote them, trans oral history is having a moment, what are potential pitfalls and how do we really make sure we're approaching the subject with care? So let's start our conversation by having you describe what you see as this moment of trans oral history.
Merle, you want to take this one? Let's get us started.
Sure. I mean, really, I think what we are trying to describe is just the like amazing energy that is happening in the development of fantastic trans oral history projects. I think the New York City Trans Oral History Project deserves like the biggest shout out here for really catalyzing energy around this, and also suggesting for us a model that we both think is really awesome for doing it well, for producing oral histories that resist in some ways the like strict identitarian impulse of identity specific oral history projects, and instead focusing on the way that transness is shaped by things like gentrification or place or relationship, which is part of what we're suggesting in our article is so important and like generative about trans oral history.
I think another aspect to all of this is that really, I think increasingly folks are looking for archival material to write trans histories. And there's not a lot there unless it's coming from medicine or law, a kind of pathologizing discourse, if you will. And so I think trans history is having a moment that was somewhat similar to gay and lesbian history, you know, 30 years ago, et cetera, when there was a need to do oral histories in order to actually create an archive that's in our case, you know, that's a trans positive, trans centric archive that starts with the stories of trans people themselves in historical perspective. And it's also oral history, as you know, is also as a praxis, it's very much about creating a sense of belonging and community as well. I'm putting community in quotes because we know that's a complex term, but the doing and the making of an oral history project, for any kind of oral history project, can do that kind of important political and cultural work of bringing people together and helping people understand that their experiences have value, that they're important, that people need to them and want to know about them, not only in the present, but also, of course, in the future.
Yeah, I can really see, you know, many groups, identity groups, you know, who have not traditionally left that paper trail in the archives have needed. I mean, that's where really oral history has been essential and magical, I think, in filling those absences in the archive. It does seem like a natural progression. So it's wonderful to have a body of work now that can help tell the history of trans experiences. However, of course, this comes with, you know, potential pitfalls, potential risks. And some of it I see is really intersecting it with where oral history as a field is in the 21st century. Now that digital audio is so easy and accessible, anyone can record stories, and, you know, the sort of StoryCorps model of engaging with short snippets, emotional conversations, has bled into all of oral history work, for sure, as we try to engage new audiences and make our work relevant. So storytelling really is a buzzword in all sorts of areas, including oral history. What are some of the dangers or limitations to this idea or perception of oral history as storytelling, particularly as you see it relating to trans oral history?
For me, I think the biggest pitfall in general is that it's individualizing, that it's decontextualizing, that it tends to prioritize, like, storytelling as a form tends to hone in on character, right? Like, that's the sort of narrative impulse of storytelling, is to focus in on character, an individual character overcoming something and undergoing personal growth, right? And that's not how life is. And that's certainly not how trans history is, right? Trans history is about community, and it's about political movement, right? Trans history happens in relationship, in community. And so for me, the danger is that it decontextualizes trans experience. And that sort of dovetails with a problematic impulse in queer and trans life generally, which is also about decontextualizing, right? Like, the story, the trans narrative tends to be one that is individualized and pathologized, right? About, like, dysphoric childhood, family rejection, medical transition, and then sort of redemption, right? And in fact, actually, what leads to trans thriving is community building and political at work, you know? And so the danger from my perspective of trans storytelling is that it actually privileges a narrative that ends up actually being, I think, damaging, and obscures the work that's actually necessary to ensure trans thriving, which is fundamental political change of racialized capitalism. Do you want to add in, Elspeth?
Well, I was just going to say the other consideration is one of audience, right? So, and by the way, I really want to give a shout out to this fabulous article by Alexander Freund that sort of discusses all of this about neoliberalism, oral history and neoliberalism, which, if I remember correctly, I'm sure I can come up with the title, Under Storytelling Spell, Oral History in a Neoliberal Age. But I wanted to also emphasize the centrality of audience and who the implied and actual audiences are of oral histories and oral history clips and any kind of research creation that comes out of oral history, like, for example, the interview that we're doing right now. So the implied audience for this particular interview is not necessarily a trans audience, right? It's a kind of oral history community of praxis that's quite broad. Whereas if you're in the kind of neoliberalism that we're talking about in relationship to StoryCorps is also presuming a kind of non-trans audience. So I think the question that one has to also consider is who reviewing these oral histories, who's looking at them, under what contexts, and that really is going to help shape what kinds of narrative one can sort of get away with without additional contextualization, etc., because there's a certain set of knowledges that one can assume around certain audiences. That's always the case. But the challenges with oral history and digital age is you cannot, in fact, necessarily control who's going to have access, all right? So the uses to which these oral histories can be put by others is a real challenge, right? And this is obviously not a problem only to for people who are identify as trans or are working with trans histories. It's also a challenge for any marginalized community. Like, for example, these are issues that have been talked about at great length with great thoughtfulness in Indigenous archives, for example. Who gets to have access to archival materials, under what conditions, under what kinds of metadata? So these are similar kinds of questions that I'm not sure we're really that far along in terms of discussing in the context of trans and queer oral history, but I think there's some relevant lessons to be thought about there.
I'm so glad you mentioned Alexander Foran's article, a really important piece, I agree. And we'll put a link to it on the so-called episode page for OHR Conversations to make sure readers have access to that as well, because it is a really instrumental, I think, look at it's a different kind of cautionary tale about the influence of digital technology on the field of oral history. Not just that we want to throw everything up online, but it really interrogates our motivations as storytellers, as collectors of stories, and it's easy to want to for oral histories to want to embrace all of this great new audience that is interested. But I really appreciate both your work and Foran's work in calling us to pause and consider the implications there. While we're on the subject.
I'm just going to add that, I mean, I think Foran talks about this a little bit, and we really don't talk about it very much in our piece, but what we're also talking about is in this neoliberal context of storytelling, the production of an emotional and affective arc, and then capturing that for a particular neoliberal end, which is exactly the emotional journey of advertising, right? Mm-hmm. The whole point is to produce an emotion, whether it's anxiety over halitosis or, you know, delight about seeing a long lost relative, and then tie it to the sales message, you know, you need Listerine or whatever. So it's very, very similar kind of commercialized affect that you see in this kind of neoliberal arc. And that what I think we're trying to do within the context of trans oral history is sidestep that foregone conclusion around telling a powerful story from a trans perspective. But the strategies on the evasive maneuvers, if you will, around the ending point of that emotional arc, I think we're all figuring out, frankly, and as we're doing these oral histories in a neoliberal age.
In your article, sorry, I didn't mean to derail you. In your article, you describe really this great metaphor of the trapdoor as sort of the trapdoor to a potential third space that it's kind of I'll have to have you really describe this metaphor better than I'm doing at the moment. But the idea, you know, trans visibility has really shifted in the last few years, at least in North America. And we see great benefits to all of that. But I think your article really reminds us that visibility isn't always the end goal or the most positive outcome. And you suggest that oral history provides this sort of third space that's not solely visible or, you know, closeted, hidden, repressed. Can you say a little bit more about the metaphor sort of and how you conceive of this as oral history filling a role?
Absolutely. And to be clear, the metaphor isn't ours. We are with thanks using a framework that was introduced by Tourmaline, Eric Stanley, and Joanna Burton in their very fantastic book called Trapdoor, that looks at the politics of transvisibility. And their argument is basically that in the context of racial capitalism, transvisibility has been sort of sold to us as the one strategy for safety and thriving. And it hasn't worked. It's actually exposed more people to violence, right? Like, a fantastic example that's very concrete is that right after Cece McDonald, a Black trans woman who in Minneapolis was arrested for defending her life against a like neo-Nazi attacker who came at her with a broken bottle outside of a bar. And when she defended her life, he was killed. She was arrested and charged. And the prosecuting attorney, incredibly racist and transphobic situation, but was like, I can't be transphobic because I had a trans sensitivity training. And I was part of the organization that provided the trans sensitivity training that was then being actively used by this person to excuse the kind of systemic racism and transphobia that was harming trans people, right? And so what we have seen over the past 20 years is the kind of visibility that people really thought was going to like change hearts and minds is actually being used to like increase surveillance and increase like dangerous visibility, right? The like fear of being seen by antagonistic systems. And so the kind of trans storytelling that is the neoliberal impulse, if it produces any safety, it only produces that safety for white, binaristic, upwardly mobile, sort of middle-class passing trans people, like for instance, myself, and actually like increases surveillance and dangerous being seenness for trans femmes of color, basically. And so what we wanted to explore was, can oral history really provide basically more complexity, more nuance, more relationality, more context than those individualized kind of consumptive, you know, narrative storytelling pieces that are about white, passable trans redemption, you know, pathologizing, then redemption, and instead look at the like life-giving political work and community that trans folks of color are producing, that actually everybody has a lot to learn from, but that are the things that are creating spaces for trans thriving, very much not the kind of white, like rights-focused trans redemptive stories that are being overproduced. And so the metaphor of trapdoor for us was about the possibility of trans oral history when done with care to create a like space for those trans stories that are stories of intersectionality, that are stories of relationality, that are stories of context and community. Do you want to add to that, Elspeth?
Well, I was just going to say, for like from a kind of theoretical viewpoint, the whole concept of visibility as a trap, of course, comes from Foucault, and that's where the whole collection comes from. That understanding of the pitfalls of visibility. But looking at this question from the perspective of visuality studies, if you will, there's been a sort of counter movement towards this conceptualization of visibility as always already being a trap, a la Foucault, which is really to think about the performativity of visuality, the ways in which images themselves do the world. They create things. They have a capacity to make things happen. And some of those things can be a positive things. Like if you think about the relationship between, say, queer and trans, you know, family photography, however you define it, they help constitute a beingness in the world through the visual that is actually can be positive and important. And this is an argument that's been really well elaborated in the context of Black photo studies, in particular African-American visual culture studies, and looking at the ways in which Black visuality kind of is a sort of counter archive to a public discourse of Black criminality and the ways in which photographs can help disrupt and create other kinds of alternative possibilities for world making for Black people. So that first, I think, was part of what we were thinking about in terms of trying to understand a way to recognize the centrality of the visual, which oral histories are, because we were doing video oral histories through Zoom, and they're circulating in a visual way online through digital ways. And so are there other ways that we can think about visuality that isn't a kind of Pollyannish kind of liberal integrationist framing of how these stories might work?
One thought, which is just to like reflect for a moment on the context of just the incredibly like virulent and dangerous like political context of trans life in the US in particular, that's actually even more intense than it was even when we were writing. And certainly the most intense it's been in my, you know, lifetime, actually, where in that the incredibly emboldened white nationalist right in the US has honed in on trans femininity in particular, but transness generally, as a like useful political fear tactic, right? And has actually found like an enormous amount of traction. And this is not just happening in the US. This is about like the global rise of white nationalist populism in lots of different places. And it's connected obviously with like attacks on what folks are calling critical race theory, but is really just history. And there's a kind of visibility. There's a way that we, both of us, were writing about the dangers of neoliberal storytelling as if we in the US were still living in a kind of Obama era marriage equality, that like the danger is like neoliberalism or like liberal rights. But actually the danger is a little bit different right now, right? The danger is an incredibly potent threat of targeted violence that is actually happening. And they're not actually disconnected. And part of what's hard is that so much of the political response to that violence is about prioritizing the individual narrative and the desire for rights, and deprioritizing the intersectional mass mobilization, of which transness is a part, which is actually, I think, the more generative political future and horizon for trans movements, because it was the rights discourse that got us to this place in the first place.
I'm really glad you brought that up. And it's not that long ago that you drafted this article to begin with. The landscape certainly has changed here in the United States, for sure, in the discourse and the ways trans rights and the trans community are now a lightning rod. This is exactly the visibility trap, I think, writ large in some ways. So I'm really glad that you noted that shift that has occurred.
Can I just jump in to say we've seen this moment before historically? I think about the Anita Bryant campaign, for example, in the late 70s, which is coming on the heels of course, increased visibility for gay and lesbian people as part of the activism of the late 60s and 1970s. So I think that's what we're seeing again. And the Republican right and understands the Anita Bryant campaign was all about children, right? Save our children. And so we're seeing that again with a focus on the child and the vulnerability of the child in relationship to transition, et cetera, in contemporary discourse. It is a completely immobilizing strategy for a right-wing base.
Shifting back to focus on oral history, you describe in the article an ethics of care, particularly in archives. And I'd like you to tell our readers and listeners a little bit more about how an ethics of care can be enacted, particularly from the archive.
Well, I think it's partially about a shifting a conceptualization of the archivist's, however defined, duty of care from simply a focus on the records of the materiality, the files, the metadata, all of which is really important, to also thinking about the people whose histories are implicated or a part of that historical record, dead or alive, right? Because one has ethical obligations, care obligations to communities who may be long deceased in relationship to the historical record. And this is, of course, a movement, as we talk about in the article, that folks in the archives field are very involved with, working on, people like Michelle Caswell and Marika Sefor, but others as well. So we were working with that literature of trying to really think through what care would mean in the context of ethical relationality to communities of trans folks whose records are in the archive or will be landing in the archive after the conclusion of an oral history project. Oral, did you want to add in?
Yeah, also to note that, again, here we are borrowing from and extending and sort of sitting with the concept of trans care, which was created and elaborated by Hill Malatino, a trans studies scholar who wrote this lovely slim volume called Trans Care. And I think part of what is important for us to think about is, so trans care is fundamentally about the ways that trans folks in relationality, in relationship and community, create spaces for thriving and joy and survival in the face of antagonistic systems and a care web that one of my interviewers was like, the social safety net is shit for cis people, but for trans people, it's it's not just that trans people can't access it. It's that it's like actively damaging and violent. And so in their book, they're talking about the way that trans folks have created care webs. And we wanted to think about it, about how can we create oral history projects that are informed by trans care, but that have these institutional alignments that we can't necessarily trust, right? Both of us work for oral history projects that are university affiliated. ELSPIS project is also part of a community-based organization. And certainly in the case of a university affiliated organization, there are people who can be part of webs of trans care, but the institution itself is often antagonistic, right? Or opportunistic, right? Wants to, gather your information and push it out on social for Pride Month, right? While not actually, like, for instance, funding transition healthcare related expenses, for their employees. And so we wanted to think with the concept of trans care, but extend it to think about how do we create projects that are informed by trans care, but have institutional alignments that we can't trust, right? That are not, trans care happens among trans people. And so, which is why we used the concept of an ethos of trans care, right? We're wanting to be informed by the politics of trans care and what that would look like, almost at like a harm reduction strategy, basically to mitigate the antagonism of the institutions and amplify the ways that trans political organizing could inform the structure of the oral history project.
I'd like to close our conversation sort of on a imaginative note. Since you both have worked extensively in this field, and I'm not aware if you created projects or stepped in and worked with projects that were pre-existing. But if you, knowing what you know, if you were to design an ideal trans-focused oral history project, what would it look like?
We've talked a lot about this. I think, really the challenge is how can one create a community-based oral history project that is directed by and produced and created by trans people, addressing the questions and issues and concerns that are important to trans people, while providing the necessary infrastructural support for that to happen. And it's a balancing act, right? Because there's a lot of work involved. And I think there's a lot of different strategies around how to do this. So I mean, just a shout out again to the Trans Oral History Project, the New York City one, which I think is a really phenomenal project because it's community-based and folks are interviewing each other. There's a modest amount of funding available. And there's also a focus in terms of the interviews. The focus isn't on being trans or transitioning, et cetera, but is instead based on these issues that are really central to anyone who's living in New York at the time, gentrification, violence, et cetera, where being trans, of course, is a really significant factor at the intersection of those other structural issues around inequality and poverty and gentrification. But figuring that out, like how to actually reproduce that within the context of an institutional setting is a challenge that I think Merle and I have grappled with. And I've thought a lot about it, but I want to give Merle a chance to kind of weigh in here as well, because I know Merle has some great ideas.
I mean, I think the biggest thing is that I wish that there's a massive imbalance in who is funded to do oral history and where I wish oral history was happening, right? And because of the way that oral history tends to be university led, it tends to be folks like me who are doing the oral histories, folks like Elspeth and I, right? Who are like academic white folks who are in queer and trans community. But our stories have been overtold, really, you know, to the detriment of trans people. What I wish and what I love about the New York City project is that it's collective. It's not university run. It is focused on the experience, the like multifaceted and intersectional experiences of trans folks of color. So race, capitalism are just as central and potentially more central than transness, trans identity. And what I want for them is to have resources, but without the kind of like control, intellectual and political control that funding often brings with it, right? So there's some things that are maybe like imaginative about what I wish could happen. But really what I'd love is to see like Southern Black trans organizers be able to do storytelling and oral history projects in their communities with funding and support. And not just a little funding, but ample thriving funding to not just gather folks together, capture and document stories, relationship, experiences, and then have those be held by some sort of repository that is not just not antagonistic, but actually actively able to hold it with the like care that it deserves.
That sounds like a pretty great vision. Well, I want to encourage all you listeners, readers out there, definitely get into this article. This is really just provided, hopefully, a tease for you to read the whole thing. There's a lot of important practical suggestions, you know, from the fact that the life history, oral history model does not really work well for the trans community, and for understandable reasons. And that's was such an eye-opening, you know, just small thing for me as the reader to think about, oh, of course, these so-called best practices don't necessarily apply universally. So I want to really thank you again for having such care in your writing and in your suggestions to all of us as oral historians. I think we can all learn a lot from the sensitivity with which you approach your subject. And I'm looking forward to having more readers dig into the full article and hopefully wrestle with these important issues additionally. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. Lovely to chat. Take care.
It's been my pleasure. Absolutely. So once again, this has been OHR Conversations. Joining me today were Merle Beam and Elspeth Brown, authors of the really lovely article, Toward an Ethos of Trans Care and Trans Oral History, which is in the spring 2022 issue of Oral History Review. I'm Yannikin Smucker. I'm one of the co-editors of the journal. Thanks so much.
Take care.